It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we help you decide what to read next with some memes. Now, President Biden announced today that he's coming to Milwaukee to speak on Labor Day, just 2 months before the midterm elections. On recent stops, he's highlighted the accomplishments of his administration, most recently the cancellation of some student loan debt and the passing of the Inflation Reduction Act. Those actions come along with recent improvements in polling for the Biden administration and changes in political polling and special elections since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Have recent actions from the Biden administration and Congress changed how you feel about these midterm elections and who you're going to vote for better or for worse? Will student loan forgiveness or the Inflation Reduction Act influence how you vote in November? Do you think those moves and others from the Biden administration will help drive voter turnout in the midterm? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stephen Smith is a distinguished professor of social sciences and a professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Well, it seems almost old-fashioned and normal, Steve. A party does stuff while they control the government and then goes out to election, takes it to voters for an up or down vote. I don't know. Do voters vote based on what actually gets done in Washington anymore?
Well, they do, but there's less of it than there has been in the past. Partisan preferences are dictating voting behavior in the general public more than we've seen in really several generations. And so attitudes about the incumbent president, the party in power, are pretty well fixed on the basis of just who they are, what their party label is. But there still remains a sizable number of Americans who are not committed to either party, and maybe just a few partisans who can switch sides. But it's mainly those independents, those people in the middle, people who are not too attentive to politics most of the time, who can still sway or determine the outcome of elections. And there are still enough close elections so that it can tip the balance for majority control of Congress.
Do you see parties and political leaders focusing more on those persuadable voters, those people who could conceivably vote for either party, or in a midterm election, focusing on making sure the same people who showed up in the presidential year on our side, whichever side that is, show up in this midterm year?
It's a tough question to answer. We have reason to think that maybe this midterm is going to be a little different than midterms we've seen. Emotions are running high right now about a number of issues. We've seen a surge in voter registration among women in some key states as a result of the Dodd decision on abortion by the Supreme Court. We've seen some late success with the Inflation Reduction Act on the part of the incumbent party. On the economic side, inflation is high, but it doesn't seem to be continuing to rise. Unemployment is way up and consumer spending is high, which indicates some confidence in the future. So the incumbent party, the Democrats, who we thought would really be in a very difficult spot by now, seem to have recovered their position a bit, making the outcome in November very uncertain.
Let's look at some of the most recent news here. We had the Biden administration using an executive action to forgive a decent chunk of student loan debt to a lot of borrowers holding that debt, going to appeal presumably to a lot of Democratic supporters, Republicans criticizing it, but maybe worried about the impact on votes. Well, listen to Republican Senator Ted Cruz from Texas talking last week on his podcast.
There is a real risk if you are that slacker barista who wasted 7 years in college studying completely useless things, now has loans and can't get a job. Joe Biden just gave you 20 grand. Like, holy cow, 20 grand. That, you know, maybe you weren't going to vote in November and suddenly you just got 20 grand. And, you know, if you can, you know, get off the bong for a minute and head down to the voting station or just send in your mail-in ballot that the Democrats have helpfully sent you, it could drive up turnout. Particularly among young people.
Do you see that particular executive action potentially driving up turnout for Democrats, or maybe that backlash that we're hearing there driving up turnout for Republicans, Steve?
Well, the backlash, I think, was pretty sharp, and but I think remarkably brief. It lasted a few days, a week. And the last couple of days, you know, we're off on other issues. One of the difficulties for the Republicans this year is that Trump keeps squeezing out their regular message. They would like to talk about things like wasteful government spending and the unfairness of administration actions. But their message gets pushed to the side by news about what's happening in Mar-a-Lago or elsewhere. So they're their own worst enemy on an issue like this. In general, I think that the student loan issue will work to the advantage of the Democrats. You know, people who oppose it are not likely to vote on the basis of the student loan action. They're going to dislike Biden and the Democrats for plenty of other reasons. But there will be a large number of people, we know it numbers in the millions, who are going to benefit with the debt reduction with the forgiveness program that will save many of them $10,000 and maybe an equal number, about $20,000. They will remember that, and so the direct beneficiaries for them, it's a big deal, and I think on balance it'll benefit the Democrats, sure.
Talking to Stephen Smith, Distinguished Professor of Social Sciences at Washington University in St. Louis, political scientist there, looking at the road ahead now to the midterm elections and the many different issues, the bills passed in Congress, executive actions, abortion, Biden's approval rating, Trump's approval rating, and persistence in the news. What are you watching? What is motivating you as you look ahead to these elections? Are you locked in? Have you been locked in all along? Or do you consider yourself persuadable? Or do you know someone who is? They're rare. They're out there. 800-642-1234 is the number to call with your personal opinion, or if you want to play pundit and tell us which issue you think is going to make a difference. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Steve, you touched on the abortion issue in these midterms. We had the Supreme Court overturn Roe v. Wade, throw things back to the states. Bans now in effect, partial or complete, in Wisconsin and a lot of other places. What are you seeing so far in things like polling and special elections that might hint at the impact of that come November?
Well, the most direct evidence is that in states that have taken some steps against abortion, that there's been a surge in registration among women. And of course, you have to register in order to vote. So it's a pretty important signal, I think, that on balance, the abortion issue is likely to work in the favor of the Democrats. And that's not too surprising. You know, in politics, generally speaking, negative reactions to what's going on motivate people more than positive ones. And those who are upset with the Supreme Court decision and when the actions taken in many states are more likely to be motivated to vote than those who favored it. So on balance, that works for the Democrats. And since women are already favor Democrats more than Republicans, the gender gap might even be larger this time. And that's probably good news for the Democrats. So there are a number of things here, Rob, that work in favor of the Democrats. Nevertheless, the Republicans are holding their own in most of the polls about who people intend to vote for. But the distance between the two parties has narrowed considerably. Essentially, the average of the polls now shows essentially a tie on what's called the generic congressional ballot. That is, people are asked in general whether they intend to vote for the Democrat or Republican candidate for Congress in their district. And it's now on a national basis about a tie. And so that's an improvement over the last few months for the Democrats. However, districting advantages the Republicans. So a tie vote in national polls means that the Republicans will probably win more districts, almost certainly will. I would hazard a guess based on the good studies I've read. If a tie vote's likely to produce about a 15 or 20 seat Republican advantage. And that's enough to make the the House majority Republican after the election.
We're talking to Washington University social sciences and political science professor Steve Smith about the upcoming midterm elections and how recent action from the Biden administration, recent bills passed by Congress, might influence voter turnout. You can join in at 800-642-1234 on particular issues. Do you approve of the Biden administration's student loan, a partial forgiveness, or some of the bills passed in Congress by the Democrats, the one focused on climate change, the infrastructure bill? Do the administration's actions change how you're going to vote this November? Does abortion motivate you, whichever side you're on? Do you know people who are maybe paying more attention to the elections because of that or the other issues we're talking about? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Oh, and our races here in Wisconsin, should ask you about those. The Senate race, Mandela Barnes, incumbent Ron Johnson. What do you want to hear from them? What issues have you excited or worried about one or the other? How about Evers Michaels for governor? Same questions, 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Steve Smith, professor of political science and social sciences at Washington University in St. Louis, with us today looking at how things like student loan debt forgiveness, the Inflation Reduction Act, other recent action from the Biden administration could affect voters, mobilize them on one side or another in the November midterm elections. You could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. What are you paying attention to in these elections? What race is front and center in your mind? Is there a particular issue that has you excited or worried for the November elections? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Kathy from Harsha called in and said she wants to see representative government again. She thinks political parties are keeping us from having representation and that politicians are too loyal to the parties, not the people. Steve, I know political parties sometimes have a bad reputation. What do you think about Kathy's worries?
I think it's a widely shared worry. It's one that I share too, because we do worry that parties become so partisan that they care more about winning than they do care about governing. And so there's a trade-off there that I think we have to worry about. But let's be realistic. Parties serve democracy in very important ways. And they're going to form whether we like them or not, because people who are like-minded, people who share the same policy objectives, are going to organize with each other in parties to try to win elections and to try to influence policy choices. So they are essentially inevitable. The question is, how do we encourage them to work with each other? And it could very well be that the two parties are at this moment so different and so evenly matched on a national basis that it's going to keep this sharp polarization with us for the foreseeable future. But parties, I'm afraid, if we like democracy, and we like our large democracy, are going to be with us, whether we like it or not.
Kathy, thanks for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Steve, I started off by mentioning that President Biden planning on coming to Wisconsin on Labor Day. We saw former President Trump campaigning with a lot of people leading up to primaries in various states. How big an impact do you think it could have for a Biden visit, a Trump visit to key battleground states like Wisconsin?
Well, presidential elections do start earlier and earlier. The Trump story, of course, is in many ways a special case. He wants to maintain his own viability by doing favors for Republicans around the country. Of course, he wants to retain his own viability, his personal visibility, popularity with Republican audiences. But at the same time, he's trying to build a base of support among Republican activists and politicians, people who may owe him something in a couple of years from now when we're in a presidential election year. So, you know, it makes sense. It's a special case because seldom do we have a politician who is so visible a former president who's a potential candidate for the president in the future. It's just an unusual circumstance. It's not unusual for a sitting president to start thinking about visiting states that might be important to winning re-election. That's a very old story. So it's not too surprising that Wisconsin, which of course is always in the mix, is a place that President Biden will visit more often than not. You know, Biden's not going to be visiting New York and California very often. He's going to be visiting Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, the usual places where just a few votes can tip the balance and shift a large number of electoral votes.
Now, if I'm running for office in one of these states, do I want these visits? I could look at, if I'm a Democrat, look at Biden's approval numbers. Yeah, they've been inching up some. He's still underwater. Former President Trump's approval numbers, often pretty low, not much better now that he's out of office. Do I want to keep them somewhat at arm's length?
Well, there are some difficult strategic choices for everyone involved, and a president can show up in a state without having many members of the congressional delegation in attendance. That's happened. But you know, on balance, at this stage, this far away from a presidential election, they're going to be very, very patient with the president. But you know, they realize too that the president's popularity is a big factor in their own chances for election or re-election. So if Biden can come in and do a good job and sway a few voters into thinking that the Republicans or the Democrats are the better choice, then that does even some of those Democrats who aren't too keen on Biden, it does them a favor. If Biden can bump up his numbers from the low 40s to the mid or high 40s, that could make a big difference 2 months from now.
I want to turn to the Senate a little bit now. What do we know about voters and their decision-making when it comes to, you know, do I like Ron Johnson or Mandela Barnes, our candidates here in Wisconsin, or do I want Democrats or Republicans to control the Senate? Are we thinking locally about these two particular candidates, or are we thinking nationally about, you know, who's in charge in Washington?
It's difficult to generalize. Voters vary widely in the factors that they take into account. Some are going to be partisan, and it doesn't matter who the candidates are or what the balance of power in Congress or in Washington happens to be. They're going to vote with party. And that's likely to be the case for the vast majority of voters. There will be some voters who will take into account, you know, very personalistic factors, like or dislike Ron Johnson, for example. The incumbent is usually more of a referendum on the incumbent than favoring the challenger. Their thoughts about the president, though, do make a difference. And even in Senate contests, attitudes about the incumbent president will influence their votes for in Senate races. Finally, there are a few voters who will be thinking about what the balance of power in Washington is likely to be after the election. Nearly everyone predicts that the House will become majority Republican. And so those middle of the road voters who might like to see the parties balanced and not have one party get too powerful, not have too big of a win, they could very easily vote for a Democrat in a House race and a Republican for the Senate race, or vice versa, depending upon how they see things working out. The idea there is that some voters actually like to see balanced parties in Washington without either of them becoming too powerful. Even though others would then say, well, that's just a recipe for gridlock. But that's the mix of attitudes that we actually see in the public right now. It's really quite a diverse public. There's no single kind of voter out there.
And Steve, something I wanted to ask you, we've got, you know, Wisconsin's very evenly divided when you have a statewide election. And, sure. You know, back in my political science classes days, I might think that would mean, okay, if we want to win an election, we've got to moderate and move toward the center, find ways to work together to represent the interests of people. Well, it seems like that's the opposite of what's happening. Why is that?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head, and it has a lot to do with the fact that the Democrats are pretty much a liberal party and the Republicans pretty much a conservative party. There's far less of a mix of ideologies and policy perspectives in each party than there once was. If you want to make your way through a primary, get a nomination, and get to the general election ballot, you've got to appeal to your fellow partisans. And those fellow partisans now are more polarized than they used to be. So the Democrats are almost always going to nominate a liberal, and the Republicans always a conservative. And we get very few moderates elected. They don't make their way to the general election ballot in November. So it has to do with the kind of the sorting of people into sort of ideological camps that now are more closely tied to one party or the other. And that's been a long-term process over recent decades. It started way back in the 60s and 70s when the South, which had been one-party Democrat for more than a century, became increasingly Republican, making the Republican Party more conservative on balance. And a lot of Midwestern and Northeastern Republicans who were moderate to liberals, there was a time when Jacob Javits, a senator from New York, a Republican, was almost the most liberal member of Congress. Those moderate to liberal Republicans have disappeared. The same has happened on the Democratic side. Very few conservative Democrats remaining, although Southerners lost their seats or retired and were replaced by Republicans, leaving the Democrats to be more one-sidedly liberal. And that's been a long-term pattern. It's not going to be easy to come out of that. And it's hard to see exactly what political circumstances might break up that very monolistic nature of each party's electorate.
And we'll leave it there. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Rob.
That's Steve Smith from Washington University, looking at the road to November and the big issues in the midterm elections. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, wild rice has a long history here in Wisconsin. The harvest season is coming up. Learn about the traditions and the ecology behind wild rice. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Hey, if you're doing any house cleaning over the next week, keep an eye out for little things that might be more valuable than you think. Like maybe there's a baseball card laying around that you could sell for over $12.5 million. As reported by NPR, a mint edition Mickey Mantle baseball card from 1952 sold at auction yesterday for $12.6 million. That sets the new record for the highest price ever paid for a piece of sports memorabilia. The previous record was a measly $9.3 million for a soccer jersey worn by the legendary Diego Maradona when he scored a controversial goal in the 1986 World Cup. This is a part of a trend we talked about early last year here on Central Time. During the pandemic, there was a boom in various kinds of sports collectibles. It's been driving prices up across the board. Makes me wish I'd hung on to my Kurt Bevacqua bubblegum blowing champion card from when I was a kid. That was during his brief stint, by the way, with the Milwaukee Brewers. It's probably worth something now, right? Probably not $12 million, though. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear from Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson about the successful effort to bring the 2024 Republican National Convention to that city and hear his thoughts about some criticism of that decision. Now, do you ever feel like there's an author whose work you feel like you should read, but you just don't know where to start? Maybe it's because they're super prolific, like Joyce Carol Oates, and you're having trouble knowing which books are worth your time. Maybe they're intimidating, known for their genius, like Toni Morrison, or they're a super important author in a genre you're not used to, like maybe Octavia Butler, a science fiction legend. It'd be hard to know what to read. Our next guest has an idea to help you out with memes. Fauzi Taylor is the social media and marketing manager at a Room of One's Own bookstore in Madison and was recently featured in the New York Times for memes that help people navigate difficult authors or just decide what to read next. Fauzi, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
I'm guessing this is the kind of question you get a lot in a bookstore. I want to get into author X. I don't know where to start. Help. How common is that scenario?
Oh, it's daily. It's a daily question.
And when you started making these flowcharts for a few different authors, how did you tackle this?
Well, I started with the James Baldwin flowchart. That was the first one I had made. I had made a display for him at the bookstore for his birthday, which was in early August. And I had realized that after a few days, it hadn't been touched. The display was completely unmoved. And I was heartbroken as somebody who really, really loves his work, and I'm grateful for his legacy. And I just assumed it was because folks felt intimidated and overwhelmed. And so I made the flow chart and thinking I would just put it up by the display, but put it on the internet as well. And it went viral.
Talk about how you broke down. And this, speaking of authors who've written a lot, James Baldwin has written a lot. How did you break down, I guess, the mood people were coming in with to help them figure out where to start with an author like James Baldwin?
Well, I think first you have to figure out if you want fiction or nonfiction. And from that point, you know, we can get into titles. But the first breakdown of the flowchart is fiction or nonfiction. And then the choices are, I want to be happy. And that leads to go read a different author. I want to cry a little. And that leads to If Beale Street Could Talk. Or I want to sob, which leads to Giovanni's Room. And then there's four choices over on nonfiction, which lead to essay collections that are a few of my favorites. These are all the books that I generally hand sell to customers when they come in and they're even remotely interested in reading James Baldwin. I think that these are great examples of his ability as a writer and as a critic, and are good places to start, knowing that there's so much more after that you're going to get to read if you like it.
And once you put the viral meme online and that chart in the store, did people start picking up books off that display?
Yeah, it's been really nice. We've sold a lot of him in the store recently, and even more affecting. People have been sending photos of, you know, The Fire Next Time or Giovanni's Room that they've just picked up because of these flow charts, and saying, this is my first James Baldwin. I'm so excited. Like, here are my thoughts. And as somebody who loves his work, there's really nothing better than that.
How valuable is it to not have just like a one size fits all, like, oh, you want author X, you got to read this one book first?
Yeah, I think you have to be a nerd about a specific writer and to know a little like the breadth of their work, to know where someone can find their window into their work. Not everyone's going to want to sit down and read The Price of the Ticket, which is almost all of his collected nonfiction. Someone that could be really intimidating. For some others, it's going to be a great pick because they don't want to have to pick just one essay. I think you really have to be a nerd. I think that whatever you want to read, whether it's Toni Morrison or Octavia Butler or whatever you're trying to get into, queer science fiction, you just have to find somebody who's really passionate about it, whether it's online or at the library or your local bookstore.
Now, I'm thinking about what you've done here. I'd be pretty intimidated because I think, you know, I read a lot, but I don't think I know anybody's work all the way across the board enough, you know, unless they only wrote one book, to be able to do this. How did you set the bar for yourself in deciding which authors you could do these charts for?
Really, the charts reflect our expertise as a team at A Room of One's Own. There are a few that I made and curated personally, which are like the James Baldwin one, the abolitionist one, but the Toni Morrison one, my coworker Anita helped me with, the queer science fiction and fantasy one, Gretchen helped me with, the romance and feminist fiction Sid helped me with. So we're really only able to make charts that reflect the things that we really like to nerd out on.
I learned from that New York Times piece that I mentioned, not only did some of your charts go viral, the idea of making these flow charts did, and some other people now have picked it up and tackled different authors or different genres. Was that exciting for you to see the concept go viral?
Yeah, it was. It's really cool. Whatever makes reading more exciting for folks, I'm really into. And also, there have been a lot of librarians and teachers who have reached out being like, this is such a good idea for a project to do with my students. Do you mind if we do it? And I'm just like, oh my, yes, please, please. And show us what they come up with, you know?
And before I let you go, let's flip things around. Is there an author out there or a genre where you wish someone else would make a chart to help you decide what to read next?
Ooh, you know, I need to read more Toni Morrison. So I'm actually going to be using the Toni Morrison chart that my coworker helped me make to read more of her. So I'll be putting it to use.
Fozzie, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Fozzie Taylor is the social media and marketing manager at A Room of One's Own bookstore in Madison. They talked to us about flowchart memes that they and colleagues make that help people decide what to read, especially for authors who have written a lot. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story of the man behind an action hero.
You know the action movie character John Wick, the assassin who avenges the death of his dog? Well, did you know the real John Wick lives in Wisconsin? Matt Geiger introduces us to him.
I'm sitting in a roadside diner in Arena when John Wick walks through the door. The John Wick. The John Wick you may be better acquainted with is an assassin in a black suit with matching hair and beard. Over the course of three movies, he has killed somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 bad guys. Played by an earnest Keanu Reeves, he uses a pencil and a dusty book of Russian fairy tales, among other things, as lethal weapons.
People keep asking if I'm back, and I haven't really had an answer. But now, yeah, I'm thinking I'm back.
Of course, on the other hand. Back in the diner, the man next to me is 96, deaf, and uses a walker to get around. He eats here 6 days a week, and shortly after he arrives, a tall glass of cold milk and a bowl brimming with fruit are placed on the table in front of him. Wick has lived in Mazamani since 1955. He wears a wedding ring in remembrance of Helen, the woman he married in 1947. How did this John Wick in the movie John Wick come to share a name? The answer is screenwriter Derek Kolstad, who happens to be the real John Wick's grandson.
And he wrote a movie called Scorn. And in that movie, he named the assassin John Wick for his grandfather. And the assassin's wife, Helen, for his grandmother. It was Keanu Reeves who, in a desire to create a series of movies, who removed the name Scorn and gave it the name John Wick.
So what does he think of the movies that bear his name and have racked up more than $500 million at the global box office?
No, I haven't seen them. And Derek knows I haven't seen him. I don't go to movies because I can't hear them. I don't have television because I can't hear it.
Despite not seeing or hearing them, he has enjoyed their success.
Oh, yeah. That's been fun. I've enjoyed that. Yeah.
In the movies, Wick fights against villains who killed a puppy that was a gift from his recently deceased wife.
When Ellen died, I lost everything. Until that dog arrived on my doorstep. And your son took that from me.
As I sit here with Mr. Wick, it occurs to me just how important the real Helen, who died 5 years ago, is. The real John Wick grew up on a farm, joined the U.S. Navy, and had a long career in construction. He proudly points out the size of his family, his clan, as he calls them, which includes 58 people. Despite all the fun and outlandish aesthetics and action of the films, perhaps what makes these stories so popular is how they capture the bond between two people. When someone we love is taken in real life, usually simply by time rather than assassins, we are left to go on without them. But we refuse. We hold on, and in our memories, in the stories we tell, we keep them here in our world just a little longer.
Over the years, Helen and I often went into Madison to eat and go to a movie. Just the two of us, not with the kids.
John Wick's grandson told a story that's been seen and heard by millions of people. Here in Grandma Mary's diner, surrounded by clattering dishes and far from Hollywood, the original John Wick tells his own story. Not of the movies that bear his name, but of the films he used to see all those years ago and the person with whom he saw them.
Writer Matt Geiger brought us that story on the real John Wick. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, the mayor of Milwaukee joins the show to talk about the Republican National Convention coming to the city in 2 years and how local leaders and businesses are getting ready. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. The city of Milwaukee is getting ready to host the Republican National Convention in 2024. That decision was made official earlier this month. That's after the 2020 Democratic Convention in Milwaukee was dramatically dialed back because of the pandemic. Local officials and business leaders are celebrating the potential economic impact for the city. A coalition of activist groups has criticized the news, saying the benefits aren't likely to help Milwaukee's most underserved communities. Cavalier Johnson is the mayor of Milwaukee. Mayor Johnson, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
What were some of the things you think pushed Milwaukee over the top to bring the RNC in?
A couple of things. One is the bipartisan nature in which I approached landing the convention. Our partners, not just in the host committee, but in the business community, as well as the fact that Milwaukee's got a turnkey operation. We just won the Democratic National Convention for 2020, and although the convention did not play out as all of us would have hoped, I think that the Republican National Committee saw the value, not just in Milwaukee being selected by the DNC, but also the investments and the like that we had in place for that convention.
What work needs to be done now between now and that convention in 2024?
So we'll be working with our partners in a whole host of different levels. I mean, obviously, there's additional dollars that have to continue to be raised. The police department will be working with our partners in other levels of government. Other police departments are federal partners as well, including with the United States Secret Service. The host committee will be working with businesses, working to make sure that folks in our city have the opportunity to bid on, participate in the contracting opportunities with the RNC as well. So there's a lot of work that has to happen between now and when the convention takes place in our city in 2024.
What do you see as the potential economic benefit for Milwaukee?
I see the economic benefits as huge, not just for the convention, but for other large-scale events that will come after the convention is done. When the convention comes here, there's going to be millions and millions of dollars that are spent right here in our local economy, in our hotels, in our bars, in our restaurants, for the people who work in those facilities as well. Think about the busboys. Think about the maids and hotels. All those folks are going to see an interest in this. They're going to get some reward from the convention being in place here in Milwaukee. And then after it's over, because Milwaukee would be on the map for hosting a large-scale national political convention, the eyes of the country and the world be on the city, it'll open up the opportunity for us to attract some of those things that I mentioned before, whether it's the NBA All-Star Game, the MLB All-Star Game, the CrossFit Games, bringing back things like the U.S. Triathlon, things like that, WWE SummerSlam that I mentioned when we were in Chicago accepting this. We want to see all those sort of things take place here in the city, put Milwaukee on the map to attract those things and to have additional dollars spent on tourism and conventions here in the city.
Talking to Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson about the Republican National Committee coming to Milwaukee for the big convention in 2024. Mayor Johnson, one critique from some local organizations, Marquette University political scientist Phil Rocco as well, saying, hey, yeah, there's a lot of money going to change hands here. A lot of it will end up either going into, the state coffers via sales taxes or, hotel chains and things like that. Doesn't necessarily stay in Milwaukee, doesn't necessarily go where it's needed the most. What do you say to those concerns?
Well, we have a number of hoteliers who are based here in Milwaukee and don't have interests outside of the city or outside of the state. When you think about the Marcus Hotels and Resorts, they're based right here in Milwaukee. You've got other hoteliers who are present and on the ground and have operations right downtown in the epicenter of where the events are going to take place. Obviously, those folks who work in the food and beverage industry here in our city, they are based here and they will see the benefit. Their employees will also see the benefit directly without, having to worry about some out-of-state firm that's involved here as well. So I think that a lot of folks, a lot of businesses, a lot of people who work for those businesses right here in the city will see a tremendous benefit from having the convention here in our town.
Nashville, Tennessee was one of the finalists, ended up dropping out of the race. The state of Tennessee had offered, I think, $25 million or so in state tourism grants to help sweeten the deal here. We don't really have anything like that in Wisconsin, do we? Would you like to have seen more support from the state government?
No, there isn't something like that present in Milwaukee or in Wisconsin. It's going to be on the Republican National Committee's host committee, the local host committee, to raise those sort of funds. I believe that perhaps was the play from the state of Tennessee to help with the local host committee's fundraising efforts. My understanding is that, you know, the host committee here is primed and ready to host the convention and will do whatever they need to in order to raise the requisite amount of dollars. So I'll leave that to the host committee to do. I think that we've done our part here, but in terms of additional aids from the state, yeah, of course, in the city of Milwaukee, and not just here, but communities throughout the state, we need additional support generally from the state of Wisconsin.
Some of the groups already planning protests are making a partisan distinction here, saying, hey, Republicans, as they see it, don't serve the needs of the people of Milwaukee very well. How would you encourage people to cross the aisle there and have an open mind?
Well, a couple of things. Look, I think it's well documented that I'm not a Republican myself. I'm a Democrat. I'm proud to be a Democrat as well. And just because we play host to the Republican National Convention does not mean that anybody is signing up for the platform of the Republican Party. I certainly am not. But that doesn't mean that we can't be cordial or be welcoming or engage in a conversation with folks that we happen to disagree with. And for those folks that do have, you know, disagreements with the Republican Party or some of its candidates, look, with the fact that the convention is here in Milwaukee or will be here in Milwaukee, you'll have the largest microphone in the entire country to voice those to voice that opposition to the Republican Party and its platform. So that's a benefit for those folks who don't like the Republican platform, is that if they're based here in Milwaukee, they've got the opportunity to use their platform here to talk about that.
Now, the Democratic National Convention, again, was scheduled last time around for Milwaukee. Didn't end up happening as planned because of the pandemic. Do you plan on making a push to try to get them back and actually to hold a full-on convention too? Maybe get a double whammy?
Well, it's unlikely that you'll get two conventions in 1 year out of, from the opposing parties. That's probably not going to happen. However, again, I think that us hosting the Republican National Convention here in Milwaukee in 2024 will show the Democrats what they missed out on in 2020 and get their attention for future conventions in the years ahead. So whether you're looking at 2028 or you know, years beyond that, I want for the Democratic National Convention, I want for all these other opportunities as well, to take a look at Milwaukee. I'm tired of this city being in Chicago's shadow, being the best-kept secret. Let's be done with that. I certainly am. I want Milwaukee to shine, and having an opportunity to be on the national, the global stage in the center of the political universe, I think is a prime way to do that.
There's been a long-running conflict, I think, between leadership in Milwaukee and the state legislature, led now by Republicans, over, you know, how state funding goes to the city, fairly complicated issues. Are you hoping that this convention coming to town can be an opening for conversations about those issues?
Well, I ran on the need to improve the relationship between the city of Milwaukee and the state of Wisconsin. And I've been to the Capitol a number of times. I've had the highest ranking leaders in the legislature, both in the Assembly and in the Senate, here in the mayor's office. We've engaged them a number of times since, and we'll continue to do that. So I'm hopeful that the legislature will see that Milwaukee is actually a value added to the state of Wisconsin and will open the opportunity for Milwaukee to be able to increase revenue options, both in terms of revenues that are shared back from the state, the promise that the state government made to local governments way back in 1911 via shared revenue, and put Milwaukee in a position where, you know, we're not the only large city in America that does not have the ability to raise some local revenue outside of the property tax. You know, the benefit of having the RNC here for any Republican, doesn't matter at what level, is, look, you can't say that, you know, Milwaukee is, you know, a bad place or any of those lines that we've heard before, if we're willing to have and you'll take part in the Republican Republican National Convention here in our city. And we've heard so many Republicans say this, is that this is a great city, and I totally concur. Now let's act like it, and let's make the investments in this city so we can be a benefit not just to the folks here and the businesses here, but to the rest of the state of Wisconsin as well. That's what I want to see.
Mayor Johnson, thanks again for joining us today.
All right. Thank you for having me.
That's Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson with us today to talk about the Republican National Convention coming to Milwaukee in 2024, how the city's preparing, and the possible economic impact. We'll talk more about that convention and what it could mean for the economy and some concerns that it might not mean as much as some hope. That's coming up Wednesday at 4. Tomorrow on Central Time, are grown-ups taking the fun out of children's athletics? We'll talk to the author of the new book, Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports. Hoping you'll join in with your experiences and perspectives. That more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.